You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Elizabeth Futrell, tenor Joseph Kalea, and baritone Mark Delavan are backstage at Lyric.
You can say what you want, you can make him the bad guy if you want, but he's really doing the job of a father because he loves his son. If he didn't care about his son at all, he'd say, oh, that boy, that I'll tell you, that Alfredo boy of mine, I'll tell you, just drives me crazy. I'll tell you, it's always something with that boy. I swear to God, I don't know when he's going to go to jail. Just drives me crazy. I don't know why he had a southern accent at that moment. I really don't. But he did.
Well, Provence is in the south.
That's right. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of Lyric Opera's Discovery Series session for La Traviata. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the production. The public is, of course, invited to attend the Discovery Series in person. It's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at www.lyricopera.org. for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We'll be podcasting all of the upcoming Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring the stars of Verdi's La Traviata, soprano Elizabeth Futrell, tenor Joseph Kalea, and baritone Mark Delavan. The moderator for this session is Gene Kellogg, Lyric Opera's Director of Education. The session runs about 50 minutes. I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening and welcome. Thank you so much for coming here tonight. Now, you have all sung your respective roles in Traviata before. What was your first experience singing this role, and how many productions have you done since? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Mine's the funniest. I did my first Germont in Traviata in 1983 or four. I was 12, actually. No, I wasn't. You know, I was way too young to sing the role. I didn't know first thing about the role. I didn't know Verdi's style. I didn't know Verdi line. I've done five or six productions, but it was pretty awful. I was really bad. Telling you, I ain't kidding either. Huh?
You're better now.
Thanks. God, that's so encouraging, may I just say. You're up. It was at Inspiration Point Fine Arts Colony in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Say that three times fast. Yeah. In the Ozarks. Bugs that big, swear to God.
Joseph or Elizabeth?
Go ahead, Joseph.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. The first time I did it, sang Violetta, was in 1998, I think, and was in Opera Pacific in Costa Mesa, California. And I was so excited because I'd been waiting for a while to do the role and thought, now I'm ready. And after I sang it, I thought, okay, that was enough. I'll put it away for a while. Maybe I'll come back to it in a few years.
And she has. Joseph?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
That's a cliche.
I don't remember. I did for the first time in London I think it was about 6 years ago. By the way, in 84, I was really 6 years old, but that's another thing. And I have since...
That's funny. Isn't that great?
I have since done it in Zurich, in Malta, and I think that's about it. And in L.A., of course. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, Miss Futrell.
If you've read the Dumas novel, The Lady of the Camellias, in what way did it help you?
I have read it. It's been a while. I think not since the first time that I sang it have I read it. Sort of looked through it a bit again. But it gives a good sort of idea, flavor of the spirit of Paris and the society and the way that the society looked upon these women, these courtesans. And, you know, I mean, the opera is quite different. It's very specific in its way, and the novel is, you know, there's much more that happens. And but I think for me, it just kind of helps me kind of understand Paris and France in that specific time, and kind of it helps fill out my character a little bit more, I think.
Joseph, have you read it?
Yes, all that Elizabeth said, and it fills in the gaps which are left open in the opera, basically, you know, the relationships, and of course there's some other stuff. While Cecil Elizabeth says the Verdi libretto is very much straightforward, sometimes too black and white, and you find a gray in that in the novel.
We're skipping Mark.
I'll pass
no
over.
Comment for Mark.
Sue me, I didn't read it.
Can you, this is for all of you, can you speak in a general way of what Verdi requires of you that takes you in a different vocal world from his immediate predecessors, Donizetti and Bellini?
I would say, I mean, my immediate reaction to that is the differences lie largely in the recitatives. And the recitatives are much more dramatic, much more specific about what drama he intended, what emotion he intended in each moment of the recitatives. There's just a lot more going on. There's a lot more going on in the orchestra in the recitatives for me. So it drives the action, I think, in a more specific and clear way from a musical standpoint.
Yeah, I think it's a very veristic in a kind of way. The music reflects the action as well. So you know, and I think that for me, probably Falstaff and Traviata, that's where he managed to do that best, in my opinion. And it's it's just great music, and it gives so much passion and the subtleties and the nuances, especially in Violetta's music, because this is a hell of a role. It's really a masterpiece, a work of art, because every bar of music, every different character, different aspects, different colors, and it's great. You can do so many things with it.
I'm going to take a different road, because I, having done Donizetti very little, but having heard a lot of it, you definitely see where Verdi is going. You definitely see the context of where he was musically, having all of those influences. And you can feel the sort of bel canto feeling of La Traviata as opposed to Falstaff or Otello or Aida. And for me, doing the other stuff, doing the larger kind of bombastic crazy pieces and crazy people, which I'm eminently qualified to play, It becomes an interesting chore to go backwards and see kind of where he was coming from. So I find it closer to Bellini than it does, say, to later Bellini and Donizetti, as opposed to the later Verdi.
Thank you. Elizabeth. Violetta is one of the most challenging soprano roles in the entire Italian repertoire. Can you tell us about those challenges and what's required of the soprano musically, vocally, and dramatically?
Have you got an hour?
I was going to say, how much time do you have?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Well, one of the great challenges of it, I think, is just its length. It's a long role, and people talk about how long Susanna is in Marriage of Figaro. Yes, Susanna is long, but Violetta is long and rangy, and, you know, Susanna sort of lies in one manageable part of the voice, and Violetta spans a lot of...
Three voices.
Yeah, a lot more of the voice. Sort of three different characters, I think, and... I wouldn't say that it requires three different voices. Sometimes people say that, but I think it's very well written. I think, you know, the beginning allows more of the lighter coloratura side of the voice to come through. It becomes more dramatic as it goes along. The duet with Germain is, of course, the most dramatic and most lyric part of it. And then, you know, in the end, when she's near death, there's sort of a near-death kind of voice that you have to use and you have to find. But I think it's well written, it's well paced by Verdi. It's manageable. It's difficult. Yes, it's very challenging, and I wouldn't say that I've mastered it yet. But I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah.
And dramatically, how do you go through all those different changes mentally?
Again, that's well delineated in the libretto and the music. So I try to follow what I've been given. It's taxing, I think, emotionally for me. So the thing that I have to guard against is going too far emotionally. In the duet with Germain and in the subsequent little duettino with Alfredo when she tells him goodbye for the last time, she thinks. And those emotions are just very, very real and very vivid, and I have to be careful to sort of... I need to feel them. I need to know what they are. In rehearsal, I try to experience those, but... when I get to performance, I can't go that far because it impedes me vocally, and so I let those emotions inform me in my mind, but have to step back just a bit in order to protect the voice, I guess.
Joseph, Alfredo is clearly an ideal role for a young lyric tenor such as yourself. How would you compare its challenges to a role like the Duke in Rigoletto, which you sang for your Met debut?
It's completely different. You know, Rigoletto, the Duke is an anti-hero. He does all kind of awful things, and you still love him for it because he's so nonchalant. He's so charming with everyone, and well, almost with everyone. And basically, the music is also completely different because of the nature. What Alfredo is expressing is also completely different. But Alfredo comes rather easily to me because he's much like myself in real life, very passionate. Sometimes I do things before I think about them, and don't laugh. and it's true, you know. And I think that what makes Violetta fall in love with this man is that when Alfredo tells her these things, he means it. I mean, she's been around a lot of men who shower her with all kinds of praise and gifts and whatever, you know, romantic gestures. But what he says is simple. I love you. I want to be with you. I want to protect you. I want to show you what real love is. And as I said, I think last time we're together was, I think any woman would want that, be it she's a courtesan or no matter the kind of lifestyle, you know. And I think any man would love that, to be in love and be loved in a sort of unconditional kind of way. So Alfredo is and he's very much like his father, which is why probably they don't see eye to eye. This is why there's this kind of tough relationship with him. When he explodes, and he explodes in the opera, you'll see why tomorrow. When I explode, I am there to hurt, and because I'm so hurt myself, and that's the passionate and the sort of the impetuous side of Alfredo.
Thank you. Are you singing the Cabaletta O Mio Rimorso that is usually cut from the second act following your aria?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us why do you think it's important to include it?
I don't know if it's important to include it. Historically, it has always been cut because it's sort of, it's written in a way for Eterna like it comes from another opera. You know, it's more similar, but it is. It's sort of like it comes completely
Manrico.
from exactly that's
from Trovatore.
It's few people will probably realize this, but it's the most difficult cabaletta ever written for the tenor in Verdi's repertoire. I think even the Quella Pira is not the same. It really the tessitura is very very high and very obstinate in a way, and it comes after a very difficult aria in itself. So it's, but I think it fills up a gap again. You know, it shows the hurt of Alfredo and realization that he's been living sort of in cuckoo land. You know, that all this their lifestyle which they had was absolutely not sustainable. And then he talks about his remorse. You know, about being very. Very angry at himself for allowing this to happen, but in the end of sort of the cabaletta, okay, I'm gonna fix it. So, you know, he goes to Paris and to try to fix things. Of course, he doesn't.
In a way, he fixes things. But also that gives you a chance to, you also have two different voices in a way. You have the lyric voice and you have this more dramatic sound too.
Yeah. So. But not to the extremity that is required from Violetta. You know, from having all those coratura runs, then you have to sing that amazingly big music with my father German, especially in the second act. But I mean, the more flexible is your voice, is any singer's voice, the better, because you can color it much much more, and you can express, you can get over to the audience much, you know, wider array of feelings. So,
thank you, Mark. You are known for the more dramatic Verdi baritone roles. If you've just been singing, say, La Forza del Destino, or Aida, or Otello, do you need to allow yourself some time to adjust to more lyrical quality that's required of you as Germont?
You know, I saw that question. And I would love to be able to invent some kind of a really, oh, yes, one has to take at least three. No, no. It's for this role, it's funny, it just sort of springs back. In fact, I've done something exactly like that twice over two summers, where I first performed the title role of the Flying Dutchman, and then the next thing I did was Germont. And I thought, you know, it just wasn't the case. Just what, you know, it just sort of, I don't know if it's like a default mechanism where you just throw the Verdi switch or something. I have no idea. I really don't. But it fell right back in the shed. It really wasn't. It wasn't a problem at all. It wasn't a problem. I don't know why. I really don't.
Maybe Mr.
Drugs, maybe. All those drugs. In the 60s. The 60s were very good to me. No. Sorry.
I was going to say maybe it had something to do with Mr. Verdi. But
no, it could be. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Elizabeth, what do you think Violetta's childhood was like? And in your own thoughts, who do you think her parents might have been?
We like this question.
Shall I make an ad?
No. Golly, well, I... Possibly she was a child... born of a woman like the one she becomes. And, you know, therefore she probably didn't know her father and was probably raised, you know, in an atmosphere of a lifestyle that gave her no choice, you know, but that lifestyle, because that's all she knew, I guess. I mean, that sort of...
Makes logical
does that work?
Sense. It makes logical sense, yes. Joseph... Why would a nice, honest young man like Alfredo get involved with a notorious courtesan?
It's love. I mean, you cannot choose whom you love. I mean, some would say unfortunately, right? But I think it's love, and I don't think it's that he sees it as a challenge or that he sees it as a sort of, you know, sometimes you're walking in the street, you see a person, and it hits you. And I think that what happened to him, really. And it's also his protective, you know, the protective instinct in any man. You know, when you see somebody who's fragile, a woman who's fragile, a woman who it really psychologically say, oh, I want to protect her. Oh, I'm, you know, I'm the best thing for her. I can, you know, provide for her in the best possible way and manner, and I can be there by his side, and everything is gonna be pink and rosy. And I think that's what's going on. I mean, he does something very courageous. I mean, he is, after all, going and promising, as she says later on in the second act to Germont, that. I mean, he told her that he's going to be everything for her, father, mother, family, and because she has no one, as she says in Verdi's libretto. And I think that's it. He really loves, or you know, he really loves Violetta. There's no doubt about that.
He sees her as he sees her.
I mean, he sees beyond the courtesan, and I mean, and beyond the woman who has been with many men, and it depends who's sort of the, you know, paying the highest price, and she loves him for it.
Mark, the Germont family is more or less middle-class country folk. Why is Elder Germont so fiercely concerned about outward appearances and his son's indiscretion?
I don't mean to be repetitive, but I think it's the same answer that my esteemed colleague to my right said. I think he genuinely loves his son. He also genuinely loves. Now we're playing it a little differently. I've got my own take on it, and that's what you're going to get today. You're going to get, you know, the production we're doing is different. I maintain my own kind of character and characterization of it internally. But there's some. I think the truth of the matter is I think he dearly loves his son, and if you take the outward set of circumstances without any prejudgment, where you say, "My son's with a courtesan," okay, that's the fact, and you say, "How do I react to that if I love my son?" You go and do what he did, and it becomes a. You can say what you want. You can make him the bad guy if you want, but he's really doing the job of a father because he loves his son. If he didn't care about his son at all, he'd say, "Oh, that boy, that I'll tell you, that Alfredo boy of mine, I'll tell you, just drives me crazy. I'll tell you, it's always something with that boy. I swear to God, I don't know when he's going to go to jail. Just drives me crazy." I don't know why he had a Southern accent at that moment. I really don't. But he did, okay?
Well, Provence is in the south.
That's right. Thank you.
So you see that. You know, we did delve deep into stuff. We found that German, they had American ancestors, you know. So we did delve deep. We made a whole research. And half Scottish, half American.
That's right.
Okay, getting back on track here.
Good luck with that.
Elizabeth, in her life as a courtesan, she was, of course, a party giver and a party goer, as we see in the opera. But what was the rest of her life like, and how was she regarded by the rest of Parisian society?
Well, that kind of stuff I sort of learned from the novel, and that would be that she, because of her lifestyle, she was very used to having quite a lot of money. And so if you have a lot of money, of course you have to go shopping. So she went shopping. She went for carriage rides. She went walking in the park, I think most every day, according to the novel. She would walk for an hour. And she kept late hours. You know, she went to theater. She went to opera. She went out to eat after those events, and then out for drinks after those to someone's home, or brought people to her home. So she was out late, which means she slept late the next, you know, during the day. And
if at all.
And then, you know, the next day it all started again. So as far as how she was viewed by society, you know, these women were sort of accepted as part of the society. They were not you know, well received by the most proper of folk, I guess. Married women probably looked down on them, and then all the men looked highly on them.
Well, maybe she was accepted by the women because they knew that she wouldn't be stealing their husbands, at least.
Well, that's a point.
Joseph, what should we be thinking of Alfredo when he does the unthinkable by throwing the money at Violetta in the gambling scene?
The most basic and straightforward answer is that he wants to hurt her. And, I mean, when Alfredo goes to the party, he's humiliated. And everybody is watching him, all the people, all the friends who saw him get together with Violetta in the opera that happens in the first act. They see it break apart in the second. So he's humiliated, but he doesn't go there with his sort of head down. You know, he goes there as if nothing happened. And that worries Violetta even more because she knows his temper. I mean, something about his family, about he has a temper, which I have inherited from him. I have a very short temper and, again, do things before I really think about their consequence. And, of course, I don't know about the sacrifice she did by breaking up with me, because she did it really for me, because she loves me even more than I love her. Because that's why she does. You know, she loves me because she sees that his father is actually right. You know, I mean, this is a doomed love after all. And he goes there, and the minute the money leaves his hands, the minute the gesture is done, he immediately realizes, oh my God, what I have done. You know, I think all of you, all of us have been in this situation where maybe with loved ones, when you react in some way or you say something, and the minute you say it, you immediately think, I shouldn't have said that, I shouldn't have done that. And it hits him immediately. And Verdi captures that moment incredibly well by compounding the situation by adding his father. And by then, immediately when his father is sort of saying, you know, I told you so, and blah, 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 and then you shouldn't treat a woman that way, whilst he was going to her house and calling her very bad things, you know. Can I say whore? Yes, sorry, I just...
I believe you just did.
I just said it, sorry.
Yeah, it's a little late for that.
Yes. It always works. But he goes there, and basically he calls her a whore, and he's going to the party and gives the son grief in front of, I don't know, 150 people. You shouldn't be able to do that. And he's very aggressive. You'll see tomorrow why in the scene. And Alfredo immediately he says, "Así que feci, ne sentoro." You know, oh, what did I do? This is horrible. This is not me. You know, she'll never forgive me. You know, the moment, the 1 minute he was calling her a very bad thing and he was humiliating her, and the next minute he wants her back because he loves her, and he only does it because he's humiliated. And he's less mature than her. Because if he really was a bit mature, more mature, he would have sit back and put the puzzle together. You know, he would have seen that she shouldn't have done this. That there must be a reason why she just left without basically saying nothing. You know, and it hits him then.
Mark, have you ever been asked to play the big scene with an undercurrent that Germont really is attracted to Violetta?
I'm thinking. I saw that on paper, and I'm thinking. ever so slightly. There was one of the last ones I did. It was slight. It was ever so slight, but it wasn't overt.
And tell them about how you react to her in this particular production.
The disdain is taken a lot longer and a lot further and a lot deeper into the scene, which... Frank and I have gone, the director Frank Rosaro and I have kind of gone at it a couple of times over this, and his point is well taken, that the audience needs to see the suddenness of how it turns on a dime, how all of a sudden Germont has this amazing paradigm shift, and the audience needs to see it. And whereas if you do it the traditional way, it's almost immediate. You walk in, you say two lines, and wow, what an amazing woman she is. I never knew a courtesan could act so wonderfully, you know, and it doesn't make any sense. And so with the way we're playing it now, we carry it a little bit farther and a little bit more deeper into the scene. We're not doing the attraction, I don't think. There wasn't anything said about that, no.
No. Elizabeth, in Act 2, Violetta is quite a different person than the one we saw in Act 1. That transition, however, happens off stage. Talk to us about it and what you think motivates her to leave that opulent former lifestyle behind.
Well, I think she's been wondering wondering if she would ever have a real love in her life. And when Alfredo comes along and really offers that to her, she's ready to take it. You know, she believes him. He's sincere, and I think she really falls in love with him, and she, you know, it's interesting in the book because she doesn't really give up her lifestyle completely, but she makes a deal with him. She says, you know, you can love me, but it has to be on my terms, and she does love him back, but in order to sort of sustain them, I think she maintains some of the former lifestyle, but not in the opera. She really does give it up, and yeah, they go away together. And I think she really is transformed by that love, and is, you know, feels like she has a new lease on life. Maybe she'll get better. Maybe she won't die of the sickness, you know, maybe they'll live happily ever after. I think she really believes that that might happen.
Well, he may have been the first man that ever looked at her as a person and not a thing.
Yeah,
and
I
that's
think
how she lived.
Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Joseph and Mark, do you think that the father and son, Giorgio and Alfredo Germont, had a close relationship? And what was life like in Provence with the Germont family?
You know, hell, he never let me go out on Saturday's night. It was really terrible, you know. Like, it was, you know, I mean, he wanted to go hunting all the time, and I just didn't. This wasn't rehearsed, by the way. But tomorrow is. I mean, rehearsed, yes.
Oddly enough, I don't agree. And we can spar right here now. No, I'm kidding. I think they were close. I think they were close, and I think there is so much of the son in the father. I think you said it really well earlier when we talked about the temper and the walking up to her and saying, "Listen, I don't know how to tell you this, but I love you. I'm going to be everything for you. I'm going to protect you. And if you want that, give me a call." Not to be glib by any means, but the father basically does the same thing. "Madam, with due respect, you are, after all, a courtesan. I'm sorry, I don't mean to break it to you suddenly, but you actually knew this, you know. The relationship is doomed. You know that. I know that. Can we just be clear with each other? Can we be..." And there is something to that with the family relationship. And I think they were close. I think they were, because, you know... I'm going to say a swear word here. I have a teenager at home. That's the swear word, teenager. Did you notice how many people laughed at that? Isn't that fascinating? And they all know. They all know. And so there's an element of this that I'm living right now as we speak, that it's more than a little uncomfortable. But the love is deep and it's profound, but it's painful. But I think they were close for a long time.
I think it's it happens in every father son relationship. Is they're close when they're pretty young, and then when you know, puberty and the magic time, you know, teenager. And Alfredo is a bit more than a teenager, but Alfredo is trying not to be his father. Although he himself has to admit that it's a losing battle, because they are very similar in a way, and sometimes, you know, similar you know, rebels, and this is what happens until Alfredo sort of gets to terms with it happens to me, to me. I'm not a teenager. I'm 29 years old, but I'm you know, I now realize, when I was 18 and 17 and maybe even 20, why my parents reacted in certain manners, which I which I, while those people are laughing. Which I didn't understand back then, and it's exactly what's happening at the moment. Also, Frank, of course, our director, he wants me to portray that Alfredo is a gambler as well in this situation, which is why he wins all the money in the second act. He's a good gambler as well, and sort of his father is also worried that a part of his dating a courtesan that she will draw him further in that society. And he doesn't want that, you know. For him, he wants a woman who's respectable, who's harmless, who basically is just a housewife, like his own mother, like Alfredo's mother, and that's it.
And talk further about that. And what do you think their life was like in Provence?
I think the father provided everything. The father would think of it this way. The father would think, young man, I gave you everything you ever needed and ever wanted. I don't understand why you're treating me this way.
Distribution of guilt.
That's right. Very simple, very quiet, but very, very serene, and probably to the son, extremely boring. Go, man.
Yeah, no.
You're up.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm a father myself. I mean, they're not teenagers, thank God. I mean, that would probably be a biological possibility. But I can imagine that you have kids, and I have two of them, and you know, you control everything in their life. You know, when they eat, when you know, and in a good way, you control. And I think that for some Latin, you know, Latin people, and you know, the south of France, not that far away from where I live. And the mentality is basically very, very similar, same culture, same. And it's a controlling, but a controlling meaning to the good, not bad. And I think that some people have more difficulty than others to let go, to let the children make their own way. But you can understand. I mean, I think, I don't know if Mark agrees with this, but I think my father, when he sees me doing this, he's still picturing his small kid in his hands.
Absolutely.
And this is why he's so, he has the guts and the goal to go to a woman he doesn't even know and say all those horrible things.
Agreed? Yeah, I'm with that. That's a pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good. I'll leave that alone.
Elizabeth, I have to ask this question. Why on earth does Violetta give in to Germont's demand?
I've always wondered that too.
Yeah, me too.
You know, if I were her, I'd say, "You're in my house. Get out."
We need a deck to entry.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there are two things that I use to make this convincing for me, and one is the daughter, the sister of Alfredo. That's the argument from the father. You know, I've got this daughter, and she's going to get married, and we can't have this scandalous lifestyle going on in the background in my family. It's just, it's not going to work. It won't be accepted. And so the purity and the chastity of this young girl, you know, is at stake here, and her happiness . And this is something that Violetta never had. She never was that. She never had the opportunity to be that, to be promised to someone and to have a big wedding and to, you know, have a life of happiness maybe looming ahead of her. That whole idea never was part of her life and never will be, never, you know. And I think maybe, you know, it's something she longed for, perhaps, somewhere along the way. Or lusted after, you know. And so I think that kind of breaks her heart. And the other thing is that I think this is the man she loves. This is his father. And I don't think she can say no to him because she loves Alfredo so much, if that makes any sense. Ultimately, I think those are the reasons.
We're given a little help in this one, in this production. there's a pocket watch that Jean Mon Père carries, and the first rehearsal, I open it up and there's nothing in it. It's just a watch, and I wasn't trying to be goofy or trying to be, you know, trying to be pushy or difficult. I said, can somebody just put a picture of a girl in it? Put something in it so we have something to look at. Well, somebody in the props department was thinking, and they put, oddly enough, and it was actually breathtaking. There was a picture of a very young, pretty girl, not the age of the girl getting married now, the daughter, a young girl. And when I opened it for the first time, and I stood there and stared at it for a minute because it was off-putting. And so we have that connection she was talking about is really, you'll go out and you'll see the watch, and I'll pull out the watch, and now you'll know there's actually a real picture in it. Just giving you something to look forward to. Merry Christmas.
Elizabeth and Joseph, had Violetta lived and had Germont not interfered in their lives, do you think that Alfredo's and Violetta's relationship would have lasted?
Who said no? No, I really don't know, but I might have a seance session and try to get Verda.
I think it would have lasted. Yeah, as long as she lived.
Yeah, I think she would have died anyway.
Yeah, so. She's not going to live that much longer.
But had she lived, do you think that what they had would have been sustained?
Why are we so pessimistic? I don't understand. Let's say yes.
Okay, let's say yes.
I mean, yes. I really think so. I think that yeah, absolutely.
Mark, can we go back and talk a little bit more about your change of heart with Violetta and how you go through that process and when does it happen?
It happens, there's two of them. And one of them we play a little differently than normal. Somewhere in the middle of the second section of his duet section where he starts with un di, whatever the words are. See, I've forgotten them already. I have to look at my score when I get home now. Great. He starts calling her by her first name. He walks in and he says, Madre Miguel La Valerie. And somewhere in the middle of that duet, he calls her Violetta. Violetta de Pensateci, ne siete in tempo ancora. Somewhere in that scene, some sense of intimacy has been established. Otherwise, he would not have committed that social breach so soon in the relationship. That's one place. So something she has done in that scene, and for me, it's a personal thing because it's Elizabeth, and I've known Elizabeth for a while. There is a vulnerability in Elizabeth's performance that you don't see very often, especially in the second act. There's this simplicity in the way she plays it. And I remember the first day she held one note a long time, and I got a lump in my throat. I just went, steeled myself and swallowed it away. And in character, I'm thinking, I have a job to do. I am here to get my son back. Forget about it. Just move on. And it was a little harsh. It was a little harsh. For me, that's the first place. And in the second part, it goes a little farther when he definitely sees her agony. And he begins, again, in the intimate, saying, piangi, piangi, weep, weep. And he makes a promise he's not going to keep. He says, yeah, I'll tell him of your sacrifice. I promise, scout's honor, I really will.
Well, and why doesn't he tell him anything?
I'm glad you asked that because I have no idea. No, I believe actually it has to do with the time. I think it's I'll tell him, but let me get the little girl married off first. Can we just get the honeymoon over with and get those horrible marriage plans out of the way, and then I'll tell her.
Because
and
I think he knows you'll go back.
Huh?
He knows you'll go back.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think he delays it as long as he can. Self-interest.
Yeah, because it would defeat the purpose. Exactly.
Did I answer your question?
You did beautifully, thank
really?
You.
Really? I've forgotten it already.
This is for all of you. Have you ever been in an unusual production of Traviata or one that's been set in more modern times?
Of course. I'm from Europe.
Would you care to elaborate?
Well, I have to be careful what I say now because I will be hired again.
Like, don't tell where it was. Or the director, because we all know.
No. My Traviatas, because I did the Vienna production, as I said, the London and the Zurich are pretty straightforward. I did one in France, and
told you not to tell where it was.
I did which it was very hard to sort of be in role because you're doing things on stage which go completely against. What
come
the,
on
the music and
what did you
the,
do? You gotta tell me.
Well, the music and what the libretto says, sort of. But
contemporary
it was contemporary. Yeah, it's hard when that happens. I don't mean that that Traviata shouldn't be transposed to modern times. I'm not saying that. But if any opera is, I think it should at least make sense. That's the benchmark, and it's just.
He's so picky, isn't he? Don't you think he's?
No, but I think that's it. I modern productions can be great, and I think they're useful. I think they're also a must, but they must at least respect some basic line of the story.
Mm-hmm. I never have. I'm not the guy to ask.
You're a purist.
I haven't. I just haven't been asked. Maybe I don't fit the costume.
Well,
properly.
Tell them about the.
The chaps.
Tell them what they're going.
No, should I? Yeah. Germont and chaps. Yeah. And a biker jacket.
Well, tell them about the Rigoletto.
Oh, you want to hear about this?
Yes.
I did probably the most infamous production of Rigoletto that has been out in the last 15 years, I guess.
I've done it too.
Yes, we both done it. I actually originated it, and I'm not proud of that, may I just say. It was Rigoletto on the Planet of the Apes. No. It always gets a laugh. I tell that and it always gets a laugh. I'm serious. It's not a joke. And my favorite character had to be Monterone because he was a huge 6'5" orangutan. Now, try to image with me, if you will, a big round, you know, the whole thing. It was fascinating. Spada Fucile was a gorilla. I don't know what the Duke was. What was that? What was that? A gibbon?
No.
One of the big things. And Chaprana was my favorite because it was our friend Steve Humes, who's 6'6" or so, and he had this big white mane. It was like I don't know. I don't know what the hell. I was Charlton Heston. That's all I know. And now talk about mixing metaphors. Gilda was Princess Leia.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a lightsaber.
What? Yeah, I had a lightsaber. Yeah, we played with a lightsaber. And there was something else in it that was really bizarre too.
Giovanna was a robot. Yes.
Yeah, everybody's going. Yeah, oh, I see that. You bet. Makes total sense to me. Yeah. What I wanted to ask, my wife asked the best question I've ever heard with regards to that question. What's so creative about that? You simply take an existing old movie and you superimpose it onto an opera. How creative is that? Why don't you make up your own story about it? But I thought that's about as telltale as I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Planet of the Apes. Never. You'll see that movie again and you'll think of Rigoletto, won't you? You know you will.
Huh? Yes.
You knew that?
I saw it.
You saw it. May I ask you a question? Why?
Why?
Because I didn't know.
Did you hear him? He said, because I didn't know. Yeah, my resume.
I know. But the funniest thing happens immediately in the first bars of the opera in this case. I'm going to say this.
No,
you know, so you have a whole plan of the apes. Everybody's an ape except Gilda and Rigoletto and Giovanna, who's a robot. And the Duke comes out, and I'm 6-something, 6'2", and they call me King Kong, which wasn't very flattering. And And basically what happens, the Duke is like talking to Boris and saying, you know, della mia bella incognita borghese toccare il fin dell'avventura, you know, there was like this woman, I don't know who she is, you know, like get me this straight, the Duke has saw a woman sort of incognito, you know, so sort of mysterious lady, and she's homo sapien and he doesn't know who she is.
He is
now,
an ape.
There are two homo sapiens on the whole planet. So how, so I, you know, and the first time I did the first what do you call it,
revival
of it in summer in Festspiele, and the people loved the whole thing of the cast, but they hated the mise en scène. But so I didn't get what they got in the curtain calls when the director came out, you know, when I told the revival, I said, why would he? Well, he'd have a doubt. And she just, in a German accent, please not go there. You
know, I know who that was.
So,
she would have said, don't ask me any questions about this. Please, just leave me alone.
We have digressed.
It's still Verdi.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah, we're a little off the mark from
Chocolate. Thank you for sharing.
One last question before we open it up to the audience for questions. What Verdi role haven't you sung that you look forward to singing someday, and why?
Oh, please. We have been talking for an hour here.
I know, but there aren't any at the moment. There are some out there that maybe in a few years, but
you're not going to tell us?
No.
I would love to sing Riccardo in Ballo, but if the voice takes me there, it's not a question. So, Audi.
Same opera, Renato. Yeah. And I just, no, I can't say it. Shoot.
Mr. Mason, please note. You know.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now we'd like to open up for a few minutes to questions from the audience, but only about Traviata, not Rigoletto.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
No, that's part of the story. Did you hear the question? Okay, you did not hear the question. He asked if the daughter is a ruse, and it's a part of the. Is it just a ruse to get Alfredo out of? No, it's definitely part of the story. It's part of his life. It's part of what's going on.
So he loves both of them.
Right.
And so it's to help her and get him back.
Right. Right. Was a part of the it was a part of the societal structure then. I mean, the son had to have gainful employment, and you know, if the father of the groom saw something like this going on, he would never have consented to the marriage. So there was one right there.
Well, I want to say thank you to these wonderful artists. As you can see, it's going to be a fabulous show just from their own characterization here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.